Welcome to Nightlife, the podcast.
Well, according to government figures, they say there are more than 260,000 of them, but even that's considered to be a huge underestimate of this invisible community. Young carers, they delicately juggle school and employment. Their daily timetables are often set around someone else's needs entirely. Their work goes unseen, and they themselves are often hidden. It's left them feeling lonely and unsupported, and they're very quickly falling through our society's cracks. Tonight, we're going to talk about the quiet cost of young carers. From education to work and health and identity, the impact of being a young carer is immense, and it can completely set their path in life too. Who are they? Who are the young carers of Australia? What's gained and lost, not just for the young carers themselves, but also for their families and communities? Our first guest is a young carer, as well as a youth advocate and a researcher. She's also just wrapping up her time as the 2022 Australian Youth Representative to the United Nations. As you can see, she's had quite a bit on her plate. Angelica Ojanaka, good evening to you. Welcome to Nightlife.
Thank you for having me.
It's terrific to have you with us. Also joining us tonight, Judith Abbott is the CEO at Carers Victoria. She spent many years working with government in the young carers space. Judith, good evening to you. Great to have you with us.
Hello, Philip. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us also. And finally, we have Dr. Myra Hamilton. Myra is an associate professor from the University of Sydney. She also works at the Centre of Excellence in Population Ageing Research and has researched the topic of young carers over the years many times as well. Myra, can I just put you on that other microphone here, which will work a whole lot better. That's better. Myra, hi to you and welcome to Nightlife.
Thanks. Hi, Philip.
Great to have you with us too. Can I start with you, Angelica? Tell us who you care for and how long have you been in this role?
Yeah, sure thing. So I care for one of my younger siblings and I have a very complicated family tree and many siblings. I'm actually the oldest of nine. So I care for one of them particularly and have been caring for his whole life, so 15 years.
Okay, you're caring for this person because we don't need to have lots of detail, but give us a general picture of what that care involves.
Yeah, so I've been caring for him for the past 15 years because of the nature of, I guess, of his disability since birth, and have been playing a massive supporting role for my mum since that time, and so being a carer over those many years has definitely shifted and looks different completely. 10 years ago looked way different to what it does look like now as he's developed and he's grown into a young man. So, the day-to-day is quite unexpected sometimes, but a little bit more balanced nowadays.
But this family member requires care every day.
Yes, every day. There's not a single day where there isn't some form of support that myself or multiple family members have to give.
Tell me about your day. Tell me about a typical day.
There are some days where you do wake up and you are extremely excited. Like you're filled with so much joy because you just get to be so involved in in the life of someone you love. And then there's other days where you wake up and you just give a big sigh. Sometimes it can feel really frustrating. Sometimes I've woken up angry just because I feel exhausted and I feel like everything's piled up. So I guess a typical day, it does look different day to day, but now, it's getting up early enough because he wakes up very early in the morning, getting all the breakfast ready, doing all the particular support things that we do and routine that we have in the morning, and then prepping him for school. So he actually goes to an inclusive education school, and then making sure that there's someone at home ready for the handover from the care of the person, the supports that we do get in terms of care. In terms of assistive travel, and then again going into our routine of what the evening looks like, making sure that he's gets all the food that we that were meant to give him, medications, particularly now, and then shifting into the nighttime and then trying to find pockets of where we can have our own time as well.
What time do you get to bed?
It can vary, but I don't think I would get to bed probably before 10 p.m.
Yeah. See, you know, in that whole day, I didn't hear you say at any stage that there was much time for Angelica. Is there?
Yeah. I've now realized how important time for me is. It took a bit of time over the past years to actually value time to myself. And the reason why I say that now is because I realized I was getting so exhausted at such a young age. I'm still, I guess, young young now, but I take time out to just breathe, to just, you know, have chats with my family, and we have lots of fun still in between, you know, the times where we're caring and we're watching watching over him, especially now that he's older and he's a little bit more verbal with us and independent in some ways. So that's helpful. But a few years back, it didn't used to look like that.
How old are you now, Angelica?
I am 24, about to turn 25.
Okay. It wasn't always like this, I imagine, in your own head at some point. I know you, everyone in the family's helping out. But was there a point at which you got to and you thought, hang on, actually, this is my life. This is what it's going to be. How did that feel? And tell us about how that felt.
Yeah, I particularly felt a shift in the way that I started to identify myself in terms of like an actual carer, particularly in year 12. Year 12, of course, in where I'm based in New South Wales, you know, you have HSC, you're in high school. And I realized that there were a lot of things that I couldn't do that other students were able to do. So whether it's staying back to be in the library to study or to go out to the public libraries to study or just to have that alone space in the home where things weren't happening, I didn't get that often. And I used to wonder to myself, oh, maybe it's just because it's poor time management, until I realized that. And I took a step back and I started to kind of plan my day as it came closer to HSC and realized, hang on, I really don't actually have that much time to myself. I don't have the luxury of being able to have a pocket of 2 hours to do things because I want to make sure that my brother's okay. And I want to make sure that my mum is okay. And those were always the first things in my mind, and my other siblings as well. That was just my nature. And so it was at that point that I really started to go, hang on, I think actually I have a lot more responsibilities than my friends and who can go to the park afterwards, after school some days too, and I couldn't. I just used to call myself actually a second parent, which was, I guess now isn't
as accurate. Did you ever feel resentment or get negative towards your family? Because you would have thought, hang on, lots of other people are doing all sorts of exciting things outside their home, and here I am, pretty much tied to it. Did that?
Yeah.
I mean, I could imagine a lot of people thinking that that would be a terrible fate for a young person.
I did definitely have times where I felt like that at the start, especially when, it, you know, I couldn't go to activities or, you know, birthdays or friends or just generally hang out and do activities that I loved. Like I was always a school sports person, and there were sometimes I had to give up certain things. But now I don't really feel that resentment that much anymore, just because it's overridden by the amount of love I have for my brother and also the growth that I've personally had. And I've realized my way of looking at disability has shifted quite a fair bit over the past few years.
Yeah. Okay. I'd like to talk about that too in a moment. Judith, can I bring you in here? Is Angelica a classic in that sense of what you would classify as a young carer?
She is in so many ways. And the experience that Angelica's described is that of many young carers. So most commonly young people who find themselves in care relationships are either supporting a sibling like Angelica's brother or they're supporting a parent who may have a health condition, may have a mental health concern, may have a disability. And there's probably some differences between what it's like when you're caring for a sibling in a family relationship or when you're the young person who may be the primary carer for a parent. But the thing that is common that young carers talk to me about are those things that Angelica spoke of so eloquently, that feeling of being other and being different and being in some ways apart from the very people that you want to connect to while you're finding yourself, that thing about being really time poor and having to grapple to find time, for example, to study at home because it's just not like it might be for friends. And that kind of tension, and sometimes, Angelica, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but some young carers talk to me about they really love their family members and they love doing this, but sometimes they feel resentment or grief or loss for what could have been, and that kind of can oscillate from day to day, from hour to hour. So those are really hard things to balance at a time in your life when you're trying to figure out who you are, who your tribe is, and what you want to be.
Because that's what young people go through, don't they, Judith? I mean, that's the whole process of going through adolescence and the end of teenagehood and into early adulthood. Most of that is a quest. It's a it's a journey trying to find out who you are and where you fit in and who you relate to and does anybody like you.
Absolutely.
And so, Angelica, how did that sort for you?
That everything that Judith just mentioned really is my experience. When you mentioned the word grief and loss for what could have been, there are times where I do think to myself, "Oh, what would life have been like if I had the time to do these activities and to follow like my hobbies?" And you kind of shrug it off and go, "Oh, well, that's just, don't worry about that. That's not real anymore. This is your reality." And that's just how, what I've accepted now. And, again, comes back to that overwhelming love I have for family. Overrides a lot of the other feelings I have.
Mara, can we bring you in here too? Like, I'd use the word hidden at the start of this conversation, saying young carers are often hidden, but they are in a way, aren't they? Tell me about that.
Yeah, they are hidden in many ways. I mean, in all sorts of spheres that young carers come into contact with, often people don't realise who they are and what they're doing. And in the research we've done, young carers are consistently telling us that people didn't recognise them for what they did. Even places like going to the GP, they experienced situations where GPs didn't think they could possibly be carers because they were too young, and they really struggled with this sense of lack of recognition of their skills and competencies that they developed in this really important role that they have. And schools are another one. I mean, young carers talk to us a lot about feeling invisible in schools. And that's partly because in a lot of schools there's a lack of recognition and understanding of young carers, but it's also because a lot of young carers don't identify themselves as a young carer. They don't go to the school and say, "I'm a young carer," because they haven't had an opportunity to really think through what being a carer means. You know, as Angelica said, it was only when she was in year 12 that she started to recognise that others were having different experiences and calling them and began calling herself a carer. And this is something we hear again and again in our research with young carers, that they think of what they do as just part of what they're doing for their family rather than caring in a sort of formal way.
Do you think of this, Angelica, as this is your job, this is your life, this is what you do, this is your identification? Is that how you feel?
I now do. For the longest time, I didn't see it as that, but I've now recognized that caring is a unique identification that I bring up a lot more often in a lot more spaces now. More than I ever did before. Yeah.
It's not just women, is it, Mara? There are men out there doing it as well, young men doing it as well. Are there differences between their attitudes and approaches?
Yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, when you look at the data, the numbers of young men and young women providing care is about the same. But young women tend to provide more intensive levels of care.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of the impacts that the care has, there are some differences that we've seen in our work. We've seen, for example, that girls and young women report a greater impact on their mental health associated with their care responsibilities than young boys and men. And we also see that that young boys report a greater impact on their school than young girls. And we hypothesise in that piece of research that it was possible that young girls in schools with care responsibilities were receiving greater support from their schools than the young boys with care responsibilities because of the kind of normative expectations about females and care provision.
That's right. Because we expect females to be caregivers, don't we?
Yeah.
Overwhelmingly. Angelica, tell me about your older brother. He's got some caring responsibilities in your family as well. What do you think the difference is between his attitude and yours is?
Yeah, so as he's now kind of grown older, he's taken on a few responsibilities with me and my mom. I see a big difference, partly because we've had so many more conversations about disability and different like models of disability in society in our family. And I think that he's seen me go through a lot of emotional turmoil over the course of my life, just about, you know, caring and the strain. And I think the difference between me and him now is that he knows how to handle his emotions from watching me.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a lot more open about speaking about disability than he would have been before, because especially because of some of the feelings we've had being, you know, also African people who, and, you know, disability is such a taboo, kind of stigmatized topic of life that we still have. And I think for him, he felt that in order for him to build a relationship with my brother more and be more closer to him, that he really had to deal with that stigma around disability. And I think now I'm just so proud of, you know, how he speaks about it to people, how open he is about when he's exhausted or tired. And it comes from what he's seen through me and my mum's journey. So, yeah.
Yeah, Judith, back to this too. I mean, you see these kinds of emotional struggles, I imagine, a lot. One of the things that, and I'll come back to you too here, Angelica, in a moment, but Judith, I wonder, is one of the big things is a sense of isolation, because after all, this is the thing, if you're at home looking after someone, it can be difficult to feel as though you're part of society in wider or broader ways than in the way that people find expression through work, for example, outside the home.
Absolutely. And that's borne out by the data. You know, when we've looked at some of the National Carer Survey data, young carers had the second highest level of social isolation of any age group. And they really, you know, they call our advisory line and they tell us they feel isolated and different to their peers because of the responsibilities of their caring role. So often it isn't so much the caring role that might be overwhelming for young carers. It's the lack of support around them that means they have that kind of isolation. And then that kind of flows on to their mental health. And we know from just generally across the whole population of carers in Australia, you know, carers experience significantly lower well-being just because of what they're trying to do, what they're trying to balance. It's particularly critical for young carers. I'm based in Victoria, so we're also, of course, recovering from the impacts of lockdowns, which has just put a whole other layer on top of things.
Yeah, I can imagine. We're talking about the topic of young carers tonight. The official government figures say there's more than 260,000 of them. I think a lot of people think there are more than that. These are young people who are looking after family members. They could be looking after family members who live with disabilities. They could also be looking after or dealing with families that have all sorts of other problems, alcohol and drug problems or other issues that require someone to be there to provide care, not on an occasional basis, but pretty much on a full-time basis. Young carers are often said to be hidden and to be in a unique position which needs support, and they don't get it. Mara, what do you think of the support that is available to them anyway?
I think it's improved a lot over the last 10 years or so, but there's a long way to go. We've seen organisations like Carers Victoria and at Carers New South Wales develop. I mean, I know here at Carers New South Wales, there's a very, very substantial young carer program now that offers support groups for young carers, counselling services, and young carers have said to us they really value that chance to connect with other young carers who are having a similar experience to them, because, as Judith said, it can be just so isolating, feeling very different from a lot of their peers. But what young carers have said to us is that when they start to reach adulthood, when they start to reach that period where they're transitioning towards post-school education, into the labour market, that's where they feel like there's really this gap in services and support from government that can help them sort of make those important life transitions towards independence around housing, you know, income support payments. You know, it's very difficult for them to get their licence in many cases. And so that's where we tend to consistently hear that support is lacking.
What sort of government support's available anyway in terms of, there's a carer's allowance, isn't there?
Yes, there's a carer payment, and that's for young carers and other carers who are providing very substantial amounts of care.
What's that?
It's a weekly income support payment, sort of much like the disability support pension.
Is it at the same level as the disability support pension?
It's roughly the same rate, yes. And the problem with carer payment, according to the young carers that we've spoken to, is that you can only work or study up to 25 hours a week and still receive the payment. And that includes travel time to and from your work or study. And so if you're a young carer who's studying part-time at uni and trying to do a part-time job to earn a bit of extra money, it's actually really difficult to balance your care responsibilities, your studies and your work within these quite narrow parameters of what you can do in your fortnight.
I can imagine that'd be extraordinarily difficult. Yeah. Give us a snapshot here, Judith, of let's talk about schools and workplace, because this is what most other young people are probably off doing, and carers also want to be doing this as well. How many young carers are in schools, do you think?
So there's 2 to 3 young carers in every classroom.
Really?
On average. That's how many we're thinking about. That was the number that really blew my mind when I first heard it.
I'm shocked to hear that.
So when you think about those numbers, you apply them across the nation, that's really the kind of numbers we're working with. And then when we look at what's happening for that group of young people, there's only about 20% of them that say that their caring role doesn't impact their capacity to attend school. About 22% of young carers miss the equivalent of a day of school a week because of their caring responsibilities. So, you know,
so they can't reach their potential. It's hard for them to reach their potential in school.
Yeah, that's right. And there's two kind of broad pieces. There's their ability to attend school, and then there's the capacity to study at home. And when researchers, when they've looked at both of those, have seen that even if they can get to school, if they can't study at home because their circumstances don't allow that to happen, that really impacts on their educational attainment, their ability to remain in school. And we know from our care advisory line that often young carers reach a tipping point between the ages of 16 to 18, where the pressure of their caring responsibilities, studies and career pathways really coalesce, and they have a lot of doubts and questions and anxiety about their future, about things like, will I be able to get into uni, and how will I balance a job with looking after my parent or the sibling for whom I care? So that's a really challenging set of things that they need to deal with. And particularly for young carers who may be supporting a parent, they may actually be really reticent about telling the school or identifying as a carer, because they can be worried about things like the family unit being separated if the parent's not seen to be able to look after the child. So there's some really challenging pressures at play. I actually brought a quote along from one of a young person who said, "The caring role I have has a big impact on my studies and education. I've missed out on a lot of school due to having to participate in appointments, but also stressing about my parents while I'm at school, which gives no space in my brain to learn. At school, I get fidgety due to worrying about what's happening at home. I have no focus, but I try really hard." And to me, that just captures the dilemma that some of these young people find themselves in.
In your research, Myra, you've talked about the business of identifying as a carer and some of the benefits that may come from actually saying, yeah, that's what I am. That's what I do. I'm a carer. I'm not just helping out at home.
Yeah, look, in a lot of the work we've done with young carers, they've spoken to us about this moment of sort of realisation when somebody has said to them, that's called being a carer. And when that's happened, you know, a whole world of support has opened up to them through carers organisations and other support organisations, particularly organisations that are focused on specific conditions, for example. So that's been things like connections with other young carers, counselling, support for school, you know, bursaries for school, all of that stuff that is incredibly important and useful for them. And the other thing they say is important when they begin identifying as a young carer is that they get recognition for the really important work that they do. You know, they have people recognise them for their skills and for the time they invest in the really important work they do to sustain their families and communities. And that's another huge benefit aside from the support they receive.
You say engagement differs for young carers too if they care for someone who's living with a disability versus, say, someone who's living with mental illness or has got an alcohol and drug problem.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, so we did a study of students aged 8 to 14 years old, and about 9% of them said that they had care responsibilities. So really that, you know, aligns with Judith's figures, about 2 to 3 students per classroom are young carers. And we looked at their school engagement. So we asked them about how much they enjoyed school, they enjoyed learning, they felt safe at school, they were satisfied with their school experience. And we found that young carers did worse than their non-caring counterparts. But when you looked at within the group of young carers, we saw that carers of a family member with a mental illness or drug and alcohol dependence did much worse than young carers of a family member with a disability.
Why?
Do we
know why?
Yeah, we don't know from the figures for that particular study. But what we wondered about was whether or not that was associated with stigma, and whether or not it was more difficult for those young carers to disclose their care responsibilities within the school environment because of the added stigma that's often attached to things like mental illness or drug and alcohol dependence. And therefore, those students were possibly not receiving the support that other young carers were in their role.
Yeah, Judith, back to you on this. Angelica mentioned this, and I imagine this is the big tipping point for education when you get to years 10 to 12, isn't it? Because that's when it kind of starts to bite a bit for school goers because of exams and the HSC and the leaving and all of that. Is that a tipping point for young carers when they think, I'll just opt out of this?
It does appear to be for many of them because it's the point where the time required and the focus required outside the school setting becomes very significant. So if you're in a, you know, Angelica described how once she got home there was 1,000 things happening and she needed to be home, and you're trying to do the hours you need to do to get through those higher years of that of secondary schooling, it really does get to be a huge challenge for young carers, overlaying with the fact that they still feel isolated. There's a whole lot of other things going on and they may not see the pathway forward for them in the same way that people who aren't trying to combine caring responsibilities with being a teenager preparing to step into the next stage of life do. Yeah.
How was it like for you? What was it like for you, Angelica, the end of school?
The end of school, I actually just thought of a moment that for the longest time I was very embarrassed about. In my HSC exam, I picked biology as a subject, one of my favorite subjects. The night before, I had no time to study for that exam, absolutely none, because there was just so much happening. I was that exhausted that during the exam, it was the only time I had some quiet, and I actually fell asleep.
In the exam?
In the exam. I fell asleep in the exam. I woke up from memory. I think I was asleep for about 10 minutes or so, 10 to 15 minutes. And I was so embarrassed by it because I thought, oh, my, how dare I be wasting time of such an important moment. But also I just felt that I was throwing away my future. You know, already HSC is stressful enough. And I look back at that moment and recognize, no, that was a perfect example of just the weight of everything. And feeling like when you just get some glimpse of quiet, that you take it and whatever your body responds to in that moment, you just do. And that was that moment for me.
What are you doing in terms of your own priorities for work or further education or any of that, Angelica, outside of what you're doing in your young caring role?
Yeah. Well, in terms of my top, I guess, priorities when it comes to work, and I'm in this unique position now where, like, you know, work is quite changing and that sort of thing in my life. I always look for flexibility. I've now become a lot more confident in going, well, is this workplace actually going to be a very flexible environment for me? Luckily, research I've found has been. Mm-hmm. But there's been times like when I was at my first job where I was working in retail, it was really hard to explain to managers, hey, I can't do this shift now all of a sudden because something's happened at home.
Yep.
And be fearful that you're going to lose your job. And so now I've taken a big stance on, well, I've got to be in an environment where I feel that people will be receptive to the fact that I have these changes that might happen. And if not, then, hey, that's not the workplace for me. A lot of that actually, that stance came from seeing my mom and her having to deal with workplaces that were very inflexible to her being a mother of someone with a disability.
Because she was the she was the breadwinner, was she?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. And so she didn't want to risk that, of course, because financially we didn't want to be in a position where it was already, you know, pre-NDIS actually was super challenging. Even with the NDIS support we get now, it still is. So I learnt from observing that struggle that, you know, I've got to be more vocal in the choices I make and the people I work with.
Myra, what's it like, realistically, for young people trying to get a job who are actually carers?
Oh, look, the work we've done, we've heard some quite remarkable stories from young carers about their experiences of trying to find jobs or of finding jobs and then maintaining jobs given the often unpredictable needs.
Thinking of, for example, a career.
Yes, absolutely. So you know, there are two things. I mean, one is the challenges of getting a part-time job and keeping a part-time job. And even things like, you know, young carers have told us, if only I just had access to a phone and somewhere quiet to make a quick phone call at work, it would make all the difference. And they'd had employers say to them, that's just not going to be possible. And so the flexibility and also understanding from employers is something that comes up a lot. You know, I've heard a lot of stories like the one that Angelica described about flexibility being incredibly important. But then there are the sort of longer term career steps that can be challenging as well. You know, we've done research with young carers making the transition towards post high school. Mm-hmm. And they've said to us things like, look, having care responsibilities doesn't change the fact that I want to go to university, but it does change my decisions about which university I go to or which course I'm going to study or, you know, how long it'll take me to do the degree. Mm-hmm. You know, courses with a long prac, for example, where you need to spend, you know, a few weeks doing a practical, you know, placement in a hospital or a school are just really difficult for some young carers. And so they say to us, we just chose not to do that degree. So all of these things kind of combine, I suppose, to shape the career paths of the young carers. And the other thing I should say is that also young carers tell us that their care responsibilities shape their career paths in positive ways as well. Mm-hmm. You know, they really acquire, as I've said before, you know, extensive skills, a great sense of confidence often, that make a really positive contribution to their decisions about career and career progression.
Because, Judith, the thing about being a young carer is that you'll be an old carer too, because it's not something that you can just leave, or not easily, without massive disruption, is it? I mean, and this is something I suppose we probably should have emphasised a bit earlier, that this is how unique this role is, isn't it? It's not something you can leave. I mean, you have to tie your education and employment prospects around this thing, which is not really negotiable.
Yes, it is a long game that's being played here. But, you know, I would just to add to what Myra said, and I think we can use Angelica as Exhibit A. Young carers have remarkable life skills.
Angelica, you're an exhibit now.
Yeah, you know, in terms of the ability to be organised, resilient, able to reframe things in a really positive way, sometimes in the face of significant adversity. Mm. You know, they are remarkable. That's a remarkable skill set. We employ about 75% of our workforce at Carers Victoria has lived or living experience of caring. And we find incredible upsides to that. So I do have cause for hope, because I think we're starting to see employers offer some of that flexibility that, you know, Angelica spoke about being just so mission critical. And if we can get employers to better understand that this is part of life, this is everybody's business, and particularly for young carers starting out, providing a bit of flexibility can just return so many benefits. I think we can really shift the trajectory for young carers, for our community, and for employers as well.
Do you think, I know the pandemic had all sorts of negatives, but there are some interesting positives in the pandemic as well, in that we were forced to be more flexible about the way we looked at work. We were just required to be. And surprisingly, a lot of employers found, hey, it's not as bad as it seems if people aren't necessarily in. Has there been some benefit, do you think, for carers in all of that?
Yes, very much so, because on two fronts. The first is the flexibility to deliver their work around whatever else is happening in their day.
Mm.
And the second is also not needing the time to travel and all the logistics that can go with having to have that extra time at either end of the day. And also the fact that if everyone is working, or many people are working remotely, you're not other once again. You're just the same as everybody else. It's a level playing field. You're all able to participate via technology. So there's both practical impacts in terms of doing your job, but also that sense of you are part of a common whole, all of whom are working remotely, rather than you being the one on the phone and everyone else is in the room having a giggle without you, which just reinforces that earlier experience.
Yeah. Myra, I mean, it's been said many times, and we should say it again, carers like volunteers make the world go round, because without them, we're done for. They are absolutely vital, carers of all ages. We're talking about young carers and their particular issues tonight. Given that's the case, and there probably is not enough recognition, do you think schools and workplaces need to be more flexible? Perhaps that's a leading question, is it? Of course, they do.
Yes, I absolutely agree that schools and workplaces need to provide more flexibility for young carers, and also more understanding of their needs and experiences. I mean, because, you know, there are a lot of workplaces, for example, that have policies around flexibility, and the policies on paper say, you know, that flexibility is available to those who need it. But without an employer who has understanding, it's difficult for a carer to use those flexibility policies. And so I think the two together, flexibility and kind of understanding and supportive workplaces and schools, are incredibly important.
Mm. Angelica, tell me about your own work dreams and aspirations and so on. How do they mesh with what you're doing, and how successfully do you think you're prosecuting them?
I've always been a very ambitious person. I will be honest that I'm in this predicament now where I actually have been dreading the idea of stepping into something a bit more full-time in terms of work, because I keep thinking to myself, what impact will that have on caring? Can I do it? Can I be bothered for the conversations that I'll have to have with work about, caring? But I'm not letting it stop me. I think I've had an exciting year being the youth representative to the UN, and I had some time where I actually traveled to New York and I was so scared because I just kept thinking, oh my goodness, my mom's probably stressed out. My family's stressed out. Like, I just kept thinking that all the time. And just to come back going and seeing that everything was fine and okay, I just thought, well, let me go and continue to pursue my dreams. I want to work in the health space that I have been researching and advocating for. Mm-hmm. And I can do it as a young carer. I think it's so important to have more examples of young carers going for their dreams in across all sectors. And that's what I'm hoping to do in the future.
Mm. Okay. And do you map out plans for that? Or do you think all of these plans are entirely contingent on what happens at home?
I map out because it just helps me. Whether or not it's successfully executed, I don't put that pressure on myself because I just know that my life is uniquely shaped by my family circumstances. And so I've already got like an idea in my mind, you know, maybe in the next 5 years I'll be doing this. You know, in terms of research or wherever life takes me. So here's the steps I need to think about in terms of preparing me and my family for that. So
You said something interesting at the beginning, Angelica. You said, as I've got older too, you're in your mid-20s now, but you said it's changed my attitude towards people who live with disability or have a disability. Tell us about that. You say you don't see it in the same way anymore. Tell me about how differently you see it.
When I was much younger, the way that disability was spoken about in my context was
all deficits.
All deficits. Mm. Whereas now I completely disagree with that and see that it's really society that disables people. And we don't create systems and ways of working or environments, whether it's the physical environments or, you know, our playgrounds or roads, we don't make them in mind with people with disability in mind. And that, to me, is how I see disability now. It's how I have conversations with people. Of course, I don't have a disability myself, but I'm conscious of making sure that we respect the agency of people with disabilities and what people with disabilities experience themselves. And yeah, that's where I put a lot of my emphasis on disability now.
How has your attitude towards your mother changed?
For the longest time, I've always admired my mom for many reasons, but we've grown so much closer. We didn't identify why it was the case that we grew closer until like recent years in my 20s, realizing it's because we shared the same role together. We just never spoke it properly aloud. And I really see my mother and my relationship with her is something that's of importance to my development in as a carer, because I take a lot of my examples in caring responsibilities from her. But I also at times have moments where I do get sad. And disappointed with how much she's had to endure on her own for many years. And I will never understand that experience that she's had as a mother, but the best I can do is support as much as I can as a daughter. So,
Angelica Ojanaka is with us, who is a young carer. She cares for her brother, who's got pretty much full-time needs. Judith Abbott's with us, CEO at Carers Victoria, and Dr. Mara Hamilton is with us from the Centre of Excellence in Population Ageing Research. She's an associate professor there. Judith, are support services generally set up to support carers who are older, do you think, rather than young carers?
There are some young carer-specific services. So there's a mix of services, Philip. So there are general services. So, for example, we run an advice line that provides advice for everyone from age 10 to age 88 is our current age range. But then there are specific programs, and Myra mentioned a number of them that are available that are tailored for young carers. There are organisations like Little Dreamers, which is a youth-led young carer-specific organisation that is only focused on how do how can they connect and support young carers as they travel through their journey. And there are a range of those organisations. Here in Victoria, we have one called Satellite Foundation, and that's about supporting children and young people who have parents with mental illness and supporting them through their journey into adulthood. So there are very specific services available. Often you get to them through the kind of mainstream helplines that are helping or offering help to everybody. But you certainly don't necessarily see the same level of funding for youth-specific services as you might see for example, services for people aged 65 plus and their carers. And that's a little bit about history and a little bit about numbers and just a little bit of repeating what's gone before. But we're seeing some changes there. And as Myra mentioned, things are certainly much better than they were 10 years ago.
How much better, Myra?
Oh, well, I just think, I mean, the proliferation of young carer-focused support services in particular, things like peer support and recreational activities for young carers specifically just has made an enormous difference for those young carers who are able to access those services, although many young carers still don't know about them. And also I think things like the NDIS has had a very big impact in supporting carers.
Presumably, hasn't it? Yeah.
It has, although, there's still a lot of room for improvement. A lot of carers spend a lot of time navigating services, for example, filling in the gaps where NDIS doesn't meet their needs. But yes, certainly it's a lot better than where we were 10 years ago.
Mm. If you had a magic wand, Judith, what would you do to make things better right now? Fix the NDAs?
I would make sure that every young carer knew that they're not alone and that there are things that can help them, that they don't have to battle alone and they can support, they can get connections to others. I'd love to fix the NDIS while I was at it, Philip. That would be an excellent supplement.
We all would. I know they're trying, but and I know it's a new scheme, but it's got issues, hasn't it?
It does, and we've also got some real work to do around how we support the specific needs of people who, and particularly young carers, who are supporting parents and siblings with mental health challenges.
Exactly.
So there's a fair bit to do in there.
There is. Well, look, thank you to all three of you for joining us tonight. Angelica Ojanaka is a young carer. So thanks, Angelica, and thank you for telling your story.
No, thank you for giving me the platform to share.
It's been terrific talking with you. Judith Abbott, CEO at Carers Victoria. Thanks, Judith.
Thanks, Philip. It's been great to talk about such an important issue with
you all. And Myra, Dr. Myra Hamilton from the Centre of Excellence in Population Ageing Research. Terrific to talk with you, Myra, as well. Thank you.
Thanks, Philip.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.